This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Terry Gilliam became famous as the one member of Monty Python's Flying Circus who was American, the one you seldom saw on screen. Instead, he contributed short animated bits that connected the comedy troupe's outlandish skits, little cartoons of giant feet crushing things and Venus on the half shell slapping away a long prying arm. When the group ventured into film, Gilliam became a co-director with Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and then a full-fledged director. His credits include Brazil, The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, and The Brothers Grimm with Matt Damon and Heath Ledger. Gilliam was working with Heath Ledger again on a new movie, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, when the actor died suddenly in January 2008. But Gilliam found a way to complete the movie. Our TV critic David Bianculli spoke to Terry Gilliam. Let's start with a clip from The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. The title character, played by Christopher Plummer, is the owner of a rundown circus, but he has one star attraction, a magic mirror that can transport people into an alternate world, bringing to life their best dreams or worst nightmares. In this scene, an amnesiac who's joined the show, played by Heath Ledger, is suggesting to Dr. Parnassus and another circus member, played by Vern Troyer, that some changes be made to the show.
Well, I've been thinking, sir, that, you know, it's quite obvious that people, you know, not many people are attracted to the show.
Oh, thank you so much.
Well, you know, forgive me, but I have a couple of solutions to your problems. One, I was thinking of, you know, changing the style of the show. And two, I would change the audience, perhaps.
Change?
Yeah. You know, but in my opinion, I'd change both. But, you know, that's just me, and I'd...
Change the show? Who the friggin' hell do you think you are?
Terry Gilliam, welcome to Fresh Air. A lot of attention is going to be brought to your new movie, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus, because it features the final screen performance of Heath Ledger. But it was only a partial performance. So can we start by talking about the logistics of this? How far into filming were you when he died suddenly?
Well, we had shot 4 weeks in London, and we'd finished on a Saturday night. And Sunday morning, I headed off to Vancouver, where we were going to continue shooting, mainly sort of blue screen work. And Heath headed off to New York. And 2 days later, he was dead. So we'd managed to film most of the material on this side of this magic mirror that's in the Imaginarium. But the other part was not done.
Let me ask, how did you hear the news, first of all?
I didn't hear it. It was my daughter, who was one of the producers, called me into her office, and there it was on the BBC website, Heath Ledger found dead. And
That's awful.
Oh, it couldn't be worse. I mean, it was just unimaginable. I mean, it took us hours before we even accepted it. I mean, Heath was so full of life and energy, and suddenly he's not there. It was horrible. I've never experienced anything like that in my life. I hope never have to do it again.
Well, I love the finished film, and it seems so organic that the Imaginarium, in fact, it gives the Imaginarium itself more power by having a character, when he or she goes into it, actually changing appearance. And so you have Johnny Depp, Jude Law, Colin Farrell playing different aspects of Heath Ledger's character, of Tony. But when did you come up with that rather ingenious solution? How long?
I don't know if it was ingenious. It was out of desperation. I mean, the choice was whether we continue or we stop. And my initial feeling, because I was so devastated, was stop. The film is over. It's just one more of those interesting moments when the curse of Gilliam takes over. The curse that other people believe in. I don't believe in it, but others do. This is a curse that I read about in the press. But, I mean, I was just destroyed. And I said, how do you finish a film when halfway through the star dies? It hasn't been done before, and I didn't think it was going to be done this time. But luckily, I'm surrounded by my daughter, who was one of the producers, Nicola Pecorini, who was the cinematographer, and they just wouldn't let me give up. So they kept kicking me as I lie there on the ground for a couple of days until I finally said, okay, we've got to do something. Because it really was this feeling, how could we let Heath's last performance just vanish? And that was the driving force. We've got to finish this thing for Heath. And I mean, people were saying, oh, we got to get another actor to take over the part. And I said, there's no way that I'm going to have an other actor take over from Heath. And so I think the turning point was the day after Heath had died, because I called Johnny Depp to commiserate, and because Johnny was very close to Heath as well. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do. And he says, well, whatever you decide to do, mate, I'll be there. I'll help, whatever you want. And that kind of, it did two things I found out later. It stopped the retreat of the money, because the money was just running away, because they knew there's no way you can finish this film, so give us our money back. We don't want to spend any more. We're gone. We're home. And then another few days went by. What do we do? And then I suddenly realized he goes through the mirror, the character Tony, and goes through the mirror three times. So three other actors might do it, three actors. And anyway, that would be very interesting. But I'd have to change the idea, which was very simple, that if you go through the mirror, your face may change. You might be part of somebody else's imagination. Their imagination would be greater than yours, and your face would be different. So the first time a character goes through the mirror at the beginning of the first scene of the film, we had his face change, and that set the idea up. And then I started calling other friends of Heath's, other actors who were very close to him, because I wanted to keep it in the family. I just wanted people who were part of his life to be part of the film. And luckily, Colin Farrell and Jude Law were available. And so there we were. The three heroes rode to the rescue.
It sounds like there is no way to direct a film more stressfully than that. But I've read, if this is correct, that at some point you were directing this film with a broken back.
No, I mean, I didn't get hit by a car and broke my back until the film, all the shooting was done. It was in post that happened.
Okay. How clever. How well-timed.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, I thought the Grim Reaper was going for number three, because the other tragedy on this film is Bill Vince, the principal producer, died a few days after the last bit of film rolled through the camera. So we had two deaths. We got the star, we got the producer, and the Grim Reaper was going for the director as well, a clean sweep, and all they managed to do was break my back.
How is your back now, I should ask?
It's fine. A year later, I'm fine.
On one of your first, or it may have been your first, co-directing venture with Terry Jones, Monty Python and The Holy Grail, there's one visual scene that I've always wanted to ask you about. And it's the Black Knight sequence.
Right.
Okay? It's where Arthur, played by Graham Chapman, comes across a formidable warrior who won't let Arthur pass, and this is part of the great Arthurian legend. They cross swords, and Arthur cuts off one of the knight's limbs, then another, and another, but still the Black Knight refuses to surrender. We have a portion of that clip that we can play right now. It's the right. Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Now stand aside, worthy adversary.
'Tis but a scratch.
A scratch? Your arm's off.
No, it isn't.
Well, what's that then?
I've heard worse.
You liar!
Come on, you pansy!
Victory is mine.
We thank thee, Lord, that in thy mercy.
Come on, then.
What?
Have at you!
You are indeed brave tonight, but the fight is mine.
Oh, had enough, eh?
Look, you stupid bastard, you've got no arms left.
Yes, I have.
Look!
It's just a flesh wound.
That's a very bloody scene from Monty Python and the Holy Grail. So my question is, how did you make the call, assuming that you made it and not Terry, or how did you make it together, on exactly visually how much blood was the right amount to be really funny and yet be daring? I mean, were there different versions of this?
No, it was pretty much you see is what we did. We didn't actually spend that much time arguing about or even discussing how much blood. We just wanted plenty of blood to make it Grandignoli. It has to be absurd enough. Because what was interesting, when the film first came out in the States, we saw it in New York with an audience, and this is during the Vietnam War, when violence, of course, was the worst thing you could even think of when you're talking to a sort of a left-wing student, intelligent audience. Mm-hmm. And when the scene started, and for the first arm comes off, it was just a gasp of horror. It wasn't funny. And then the second arm, and it still wasn't funny. I think we had to get to the first leg coming off before they begin to realize that that kind of absurd violence could actually be funny. And that's what intrigued me. They were misreading it, because it's the whole thing is so absurd, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't very naturalistic. I wouldn't have thought the way we were doing it. It's mm-hmm. just clear a dummy arm comes off, but they were shocked. But by the second leg coming off, they were genuinely laughing.
Do you find that with other parts of the Python material, that some of it got one reaction at the time and a completely different reaction years later?
Yeah, I think so. I can't be specific, but, you know, it was more the transition to America where the difficulty was. The English seemed to get it, and the Americans were a bit more straight-laced and more rigid in their thinking, and it took a while to get used to it, to understand what was funny. I mean, the good thing I love about Python was that it divided families. I mean, it tended to be the guys like
people usually claim to unite families.
No, I've always loved the idea of split families based on their sense of humor. That's wonderful. It's a test of a real marriage.
One other theme that runs through your works, I'm not trying to be too introspective here, but imagination and storytelling, those are themes that you return to over and over again, yeah. I think so brilliantly. I mean, not only Dr. Parnassus, but Brazil and Baron Munchausen and the Brothers Grimm. Why is that? I mean, why does storytelling have such power to you?
I just think it's from my youth, being a kid growing up in the countryside of Minneapolis and with only radio. And there were all these great radio shows that were storytelling. And I think the first books I read were Grimm's Fairy Tales. I also remember as a bit older, 12, 13, as a Boy Scout, being up in the forests above, in the mountains above Los Angeles, and at nighttime around a campfire, and stories being told. And it's, to me, the real magic. It's just wonderful, because suddenly you're transported from your own world into other worlds, if you let yourself go. And that's the key to letting go, trusting the storyteller, relax. In my perverse way, I'm always trying to tell stories not the way the current mode is in Hollywood. And then I always get hauled up by the critics for being a bad storyteller. And yet, children invariably just fall under the spell of my films. Mm-hmm. They get them, and the adults often have a problem. I remember when we did Time Bandits, the kids just went with the flow, and the adults were panicking because we were jumping around too quickly from one point in history to another, and they wanted road signs in advance of where they were going. And I thought, we're getting into a world where people really aren't really used to that kind of storytelling anymore.
For people that don't know that you were born in Minnesota, and, you know, if they think of you as Monty Python, and they may even know that you're the American member or were the American member of Monty Python, the animations that you provided to that program are your key signature. Mm-hmm. When did you feel like you were an artist? How did your artistic talent develop?
Oh, I mean, ever since I was a kid, I've drawn. I used to draw cartoons. You know, that's what I did. I think what's lovely about being able to draw, and particularly cartoons, it's kind of magic to people. Most people don't really respect people who can sit down and write. But if you draw something and it's funny at the same time, they love it. And for me, it was, you get immediate feedback. So I'm always a sucker for somebody laughing or saying, oh, aren't you clever? So that's what I did. And so cartoons were always what I did. And then that eventually led into animation. which then led into filmmaking. But I think it's always the visuals in many ways come first. Then I try to work out a way of including dialogue and words, but it was always the pictures. So I think I'm very primitive in that sense. And I suppose that's why I'm kind of obsessed with the medieval times when people were illiterate and it was signs and pictures. It was how ideas were communicated.
How has filmmaking changed for you over these, what is 30-some years since you actually started officially directing? I mean, special effects and technology are so different now, and you're an artist and an animator. Do those tools make it easier for you or harder?
Some of them do make it easier. To me, they are tools, as you say. That's exactly what they are. I don't get excited the fact that, now a computer can do this. Because the problem with so many of these advances, they just end up making the films more expensive. And the more expensive you make your films, the more limited I think you are in the ideas you can play with. So I use it to keep my films cheap. In the case of Parnassus, rather than doing elaborate naturalistic backgrounds. Mm-hmm. I've kept the backgrounds more painterly. They're more, and in fact, they're a bit more like my cartoons in Python. They're simpler, so we could do amazing backgrounds, but they're still quite cheap to produce rather than putting a Tyrannosaurus Rex in there.
Now, when you were dealing with things like deciding which lenses to use early on, and now it's sort of one of your signatures is the type of lenses that you can use. Or now with CG stuff, how hard is that for you to learn?
Oh, I've been playing with it for years, just little by little. And in the end, it's easy. That's what I'm good at. These are the skills I have. This is the way I see things. The wide-angle lenses, I think I choose them because it makes me feel like I'm in the space of the film. I'm surrounded. My peripheral vision is full of detail. And that's what I like about it. It's actually harder to do. It's harder to light. The other thing I like about wide-angle lenses is that I'm not forcing the audience to look at just the one thing that is important. It's there, mm-hmm. but there's other things to occupy. And some people don't like that because I'm not pointing out as precisely as I could if I was using a long lens where I'd focus just on the one thing and everything else would be out of focus.
Well, doesn't that make it perfect for DVD?
Aha, my secret is out. The fact is, it's about DVDs. The fact now we can watch a film again and again and again. And for me, my films, I think, are better the second and third time, frankly, because you can now relax and go with the flow that may not have been as apparent at the first time you saw it, and wallow in the details of the worlds that we're creating. I think what's interesting is that when I was growing up and going to films, you saw the film once, or you went and saw it night after night or week after week until it was gone, and then it was in your memory mm-hmm. for the next 20 years. That was the only way you could hold on to it. And now, and I'm not sure it's better, the fact now we can go again and again.
Depends
and
on
again.
The film, I think, yes.
Exactly. But I try to clutter mine up. They're worthy of many viewings.
Well, I just saw, for example, Baron Munchausen again, and I was taken, I don't know whether I just had a better television set this time, but the flying cherubs fascinated me. Just the little flying cherubs in this one scene. It was like, how adorable. And I don't think I've ever seen anything that impish. So I don't know if there's a question here, but if you have anything to share about those flying cherubs, now's the time.
No, the terrible thing, I mean, I was actually very worried about them because they're just, you know, fiberglass figures with wings that flap and they're on wires. And I was always terrified that they were going to look just like that. But somehow there's enough action there that there they are. And they seem to work. And again, I think I'm lucky in the sense that I don't work in a naturalistic way. So it allows things to be wonderful because they're like toys. They're not complete. They're not perfect. And that's what I've always liked about toys and what children do is they take, you know, a little stuffed doll and turn it into a beautiful, you know, princess that has a whole life. And for me, what I want to do in films is to try to not make it perfect and not make it totally realistic. So you've got to do some work. You've got to use your imagination. And the more I think you use your imagination, the more you get out of it. It's probably why theater works so well, because an audience has got to put a lot of their imagination to work to make that stage a real place with real events going on. And I what always worries me about television in particular, and also films now, all the work is being done for you. The audience has become more passive, and I don't like that. I actually want the audience to work. You pay your money, and you go to work when you come to see my films.
Well, Terry Gilliam, I want to thank you so much for being on Fresh Air.
Lovely. Thank you.
Terry Gilliam spoke with Fresh Air's TV critic David Bianculli. Gilliam directed the new film The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus. David writes for TVWorthWatching.com, teaches at Rowan University, and is the author of the new book about the Smothers Brothers, Dangerously Funny. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last month, we featured an interview with Jeff Charlotte, the author of the book The Family, The Secret Fundamentalism at the Heart of American Power. Charlotte has spent years researching the family, which is a secretive religious group that some senators and congressmen are affiliated with, including Tom Coburn, John Ensign, Joe Pitts, Jim DeMint, and Sam Brownback. The family's most visible project is sponsoring the National Prayer Breakfast each year in Washington, D.C. After Charlotte's interview last month, we received an email from a longtime member of the family who was mentioned in the interview, Bob Hunter. He wanted to respond to things that were said about him and the family, which he says is better known as the Fellowship. So we invited Hunter to talk with us. In an email he sent us prior to the interview, he was concerned that he'd been portrayed as a right-wing fundamentalist when, in fact, he's a longtime consumer activist and is now the director of insurance with the Consumer Federation of America. He served in the Carter administration as well as the Ford administration. Bob Hunter's work with the family came up in my interview with Jeff Charlotte when we were discussing Uganda, where anti-gay legislation has been proposed that would sentence to death some homosexuals and imprison anyone who didn't report a homosexual. In my interview with Charlotte, he talked about the family's connections to Uganda and their possible influence on this draconian bill. The president of Uganda was brought into the fellowship by Bob Hunter, who's been working in Uganda since the 80s with hospitals and other charitable groups. Hunter says neither he nor anyone he knows in the fellowship supports the Ugandan bill. And that's one of the things he told Jeff Charlotte in a meeting that they had after our interview. Charlotte wrote a post on Warren Throckmorton's blog about their conversation, clarifying and correcting some of his statements. You'll find a link to that blog on our website. I spoke with Bob Hunter yesterday. We talked first about his work in Uganda. Bob Hunter, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, what did you do to help connect the leadership of Uganda with the fellowship?
Well, I started reaching out because the trouble was so bad in the country. I started reaching out to the various leaders. And because I was one of the very few white people in the country during this really troubled time, I could walk in and see anybody. And they would let me in. And so I met with leaders from the opposition party, met with leaders from the president's party, met with leaders even in the Bush. And I started saying, can't we get you guys together? And they were willing to try to, because they all claimed to be Christians, they were willing to try it, but they were afraid of the president. And they said the president might think it's a coup if we get together. Then I was giving up, really. But on the way out of the continent, I bumped into in Nairobi Airport a African-American woman who was a missionary to Uganda, whose father was Andrew Young. So through that chance encounter, I reached out to Andrew Young, who came with me on the first trip where we actually got to meet a president. It was before Museveni. It was the president Obote, who was a very evil man. But we met him, and he gave the authority for us to try to bring some people together, which began the process.
Now, what's the family's relationship, or the fellowship's relationship now, with the Ugandan president, Museveni? Because Jeff Charlotte, who wrote the book, The Family, says that Museveni is the family's key man in Africa.
Well, that's probably an overstatement. The fellowship has key people working in countries. These are the people that, you know, help put together meetings, make sure that people from various tribes get involved, various religions, it's not just Christian, get involved. And those are the people that are really the close-in family, and they're actually meeting and praying together and trying to figure out ways to help people get together that normally would be divided. They're the close-in ones. The presidents are sort of tools to hold prayer breakfasts and so on to try to move the agenda toward peace. There's no doubt President Museveni has been one of the close contacts since I first introduced him to people here. But he is not the day-to-day guy, nor is he the guy you can push around and suggest that he adopt a position or something.
Uganda now has anti-gay legislation before parliament that is really draconian. It would call for the death penalty for anyone who is gay who had HIV/AIDS, the death penalty for adults who have gay sex with minors, jail for anyone who fails to report a gay person within 24 hours if there's been gay activity, life sentences for people in same-sex marriages. And this bill also calls for extraditing gay Ugandans living abroad so that they can be brought back to Uganda and be prosecuted. What's your opinion of that bill being so close to the country of Uganda?
Well, my opinion is it's a terrible bill and shouldn't be adopted. And I believe no one that I know in America particularly and my close friends in Uganda, I know of no one who supports it in the fellowship.
Since you have so many connections in Uganda and since you know President Museveni and helped bring him to the National Prayer Breakfast in 1997, which is organized by the fellowship, the family, have you spoken out to your connections in Uganda?
Oh, yes, definitely. In fact, when I first called them, first was an email contact, they said, look, the guy who introduced the bill came to one of our prayer breakfasts and afterward in a private meeting told us about the bill, and we told him it was a bad idea. So even before the bill was introduced, members of the fellowship had said, you should reach out to other people before you do this. Be cautious. This is not a good idea. They did it in a very polite Ugandan way, but the fact is they spoke out even before it was introduced.
Now, some members of the fellowship in the United States have eventually spoke out against the bill in public, including Senators Coburn and Grassley. I'm wondering if other members of the fellowship in the United States who have made Africa among the top things on their agenda have spoken out, such as Senators Brownback and Inhofe.
Inhofe has. I know that. I don't know about Brownback. I haven't heard. We have certainly passed word around to contacts on the Hill of our position, but I don't keep track of day-to-day what each one says. I know Inhofe did.
Now, so these are statements that have been made in the United States. What about statements to Ugandans, like calling up connections there, calling up people who they have prayed with?
My understanding is there has been some connections. I know I have done it personally and talked to people who would be close to people in the decision-making process about our concerns, which is very unusual. You know, we never involve ourselves in these political things. That's not our role. But this one became so, you know, hot that I should speak out. And then I found out they were already speaking out in Uganda. I would say that one other thing, and that is that Mr. Charlotte now recognizes that we had nothing to do with the anti-homosexual bill and has so said so in a post by Warren Throckmorton.
David Bahati, who introduced the bill to the Ugandan parliament, that is a draconian anti-gay bill, does David Bahati organize, or is he involved with organizing the National Prayer Breakfast in Uganda now?
He was involved in this last one as a member of parliament. Anyone who goes to the prayer breakfast, the weekly prayer breakfast of parliament, where people pray together and talk about their families and such, is part of that organizing committee. So he was a part of the organizing committee, but he was not central, in my view, to actually organizing and putting together the prayer breakfast. But he was on. He's a member of parliament, and he goes to the prayer breakfast weekly, and so therefore he was, I don't know, I haven't seen it, but he probably would be considered an organizer, yes.
Is David Bahati a member of the fellowship?
Well, he's part of that group that meets in the parliament, so it, to that extent, he is. There's 10,000 groups around the world, so I don't know what they're all doing. But, yeah, to that extent, he would be considered part of the fellowship, yes.
Now, Jeff Charlotte did say that he found two memos you submitted to Doug Coe detailing your meetings with Ugandan and Kenyan officials and the possibility of recruiting them for the family or the fellowship. What do you say to that?
Well, it's possible. I mean, I wrote trip reports on all of my 25 or so trips to Africa. I write trip reports on my trips, and I send them to a lot of friends, including some that are in the fellowship and some that aren't, and to members of my family and so on. There's nothing ever about me doing a political trip, trying to gain a political access. Maybe I would like to reach, say, the Hutu, who was the number one political Hutu in Burundi, and also the number one Tutsi, to try to find a way to bring them together to avoid another Rwanda next door. You know, things like that, I would say. But the goal was always, out of love, to try to find a way to bridge gaps between people, all kinds of gaps, ethnic, tribal, economic, religious. We try to find a way through, and we also try to build groups in the parliaments that represent the whole country, so that the group would have a Muslim and a Christian and a northerner and a southerner and this tribe or that tribe. And I would write, yeah, I'm trying to reach somebody. We have these three, but we're missing the very important fourth. We're trying to reach them. I would write something like that.
And did you submit a report to Chester Crocker after one of your trips to Uganda, who was then the Undersecretary of State for African Affairs?
He might have gotten a copy of one of my trip reports. I only met him once. I could have possibly sent him a copy of one of my trip reports. A couple of times we discovered things. Like on my very first trip, I got taken into the Luwero Triangle, which was where most of the killing was, taken into one of the camps that was a death camp, and I was able to actually witness it. And I did write when I got back and told the government what I saw, because I thought it was so horrible. I don't remember if that one went to him. I don't think so. I may have sent a later one. When we were helping bring the final tribal group, the Palafa Hutu in Burundi, into the peace talks, and our role was never peace talks. Our role was build trust between the various people so that they would feel comfortable to start peace talks. When I came back and said we had actually brought them together, and I actually called the State Department to tell them, they said, "I don't believe you. No one can do that. Mandela has tried, the UN has tried, we've tried, no one can do it." I said, "I'm telling you the truth." They said, "It's ridiculous, it's impossible." But it happened.
I know one of the things you objected to when I interviewed Jeff Charlotte, author of the book The Family, was my introduction to the interview. And in that introduction, I said the fundamentalist group, The Family, has operated secretly with the help of influential congressmen and senators who are members of the group to promote their anti-gay, anti-abortion, pro-free market ideas in America and other parts of the world. I know you have a lot of objections to that sentence, so tell us what they are.
Well, first of all, The Family has no idea or agenda like anti-gay, anti-abortion, pro-free market. There is no agenda. The agenda is to reach people, to bring them into small groups where they could read the scriptures. It's always focused on Jesus, but it's focused in a way that is comfortable for a Muslim, because we say, okay, you think he's a prophet, come on in and have fellowship with us. or even, you know, Jews. You say he's a great rabbi. Come on in and have fellowship with us. And it works. We can get through because unlike a lot of Christian groups, we don't say you got to convert and be like us before you can join. We let people join. In fact, some of the religious community are upset with us because they say we're, you know, not following through on the Great Commission. But we think if you're going to build within the country, some kind of unifying force, we think Jesus can do it. But because he does cross those religious boundaries, Christianity doesn't. If you go in and say, let's have a Christian group, then a bunch of people don't show up. And so we try to use that as a way to bring people together.
So I described the family as operating secretively.
Yeah.
Your reaction?
Oh, I think we are a little too secretive. There are some things have to be secret, you know. For example, if I'm in the middle of a negotiation with Hutus and Tutsis and Twa in Burundi, trying to bring them together, I can't be public. Go out that night and hold a press conference every night. It simply doesn't work. We're trying to build relationships and trust. We have to do that quietly. There are things that are like confessionals where people tell me, you know, or we tell each other some of our issues, temptations, things we're dealing with. You don't broadcast that, obviously. But I also think we should have a website. We don't really. We should have, you know, we should tell the good stuff about the orphanages we help, the hospitals we help, the work with children all over the world that we're doing. I think we have a great story to tell, and there is some resistance in the organization against being more open, and I think it's a mistake. I think we can be open without giving up our things that have to be private.
In Jeff Charlotte's book, he says that in 1966, Doug Coe, who was the leader of the fellowship, also known as the family, decided that the time had come to submerge, and that after that the fellowship avoided any appearances of being an organization. And also, like, Doug Coe has made the analogy to the mafia, that the mafia gets a lot of its power by being secretive, and the way to have power is to operate kind of secretly.
Yeah, I've heard Doug talk about it a lot. He believes that things that are invisible are more lasting than things that, and that's from Scripture, things that are invisible are more lasting than things you can see, that the things you can see will pass away. Some of the invisible things will last forever. And things like that, which I think influence him on that. I think there was a time when it probably was okay to not have public information, but I think we should be reaching out more and making people more aware of what we're doing without giving up the part that has to be private.
Do you think that will happen, that the family will be less secretive?
Well, there's a discussion underway. There was a meeting a couple of weeks ago, and certain people spoke out for a website and more openness. Others were resistant. But I think sooner or later it will be more open.
Why now? What was that meeting a reaction to?
Well, it was part reaction to Charlotte's book and the C Street, you know, troubles and the inability for anyone to be able to respond because they just don't have a mechanism for responding. And so the media looks for a website. I would too. And there's nothing there. And so the media goes, well, it must be a secret organization, even though Jeff Charlotte found 273 footnotes in his book. So it isn't totally secret. I think the secrecy will end. I think we're just going through the process. I think the notoriety and the lack of a response has hurt the fellowship, and I think it's time to. I haven't cleared this with anybody. I'm here because I felt I was personally scandalized as a right wing fanatic on your program,
mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As a right wing fanatic who the U.S. government sent over to Uganda and so on. I think we've straightened that out. I hope that isn't who I am.
Is it kind of okay for you to be here without telling other members of the fellowship that you were doing this?
Sure.
Are you breaking any kind of understanding?
No, there's no code. There's no quota. There's no creed or anything. It's just sort of the way it's been. You know, I suppose I could get in a little trouble with some of the people. I'll find out. It's not a written down thing. It's just been sort of the way it's been.
Okay, one more thing in my one sentence, and we're getting a lot of mileage out of that one sentence in my introduction to Jeff Charlotte's interview. I said that the family operated secretly with the help of influential congressmen and senators who are members of the group to promote their anti-gay, anti-abortion, pro-free market ideas in America and other parts of the world. So let's get to that idea of promoting anti-gay, anti-abortion, pro-free market ideas around the world.
Well, the fellowship does not promote any agenda that's political. The only agenda is to get to reach people and try to bring them closer to God and to each other in a way that would help people. Hopefully, even though it doesn't seem to be working, Republicans and Democrats would respect each other better if they sat down and prayed with each other and learned about each other's families and, you know, shared each other's pains and triumphs and so on.
The fellowship, also known as a family, raises some complicated questions about the separation between church and state. And I'll give you an example of what I mean here. Senator James Inhofe of Oklahoma spoke, and there's a clip of this on YouTube. I'd play the sound, except the sound's a little too muddy for the radio. I think our listeners would have trouble hearing it. But he's talking to Rob Schenck, who's the founder of a ministry called Faith in Action in the nation's capital. And in this conversation, he says that Jesus said, "Take my name, Jesus, to the kings." And Inhofe says, if you're a member of the U.S. Senate in Africa, they think you're important, so you always get in to see the kings. The first one you went to see was a guy that our State Department thought was the worst terrorist in the world, Sonny Abacha from Nigeria. He started talking about political things, and so after a little while I said, "Mr. President, really? Yeah, I'm a member of the U.S. Senate, but I didn't come over here as a senator. In fact, I came all the way across the Atlantic down to sub-Saharan Africa to tell you that in the spirit of Jesus, we love you." Now, he's saying, Senator Inhofe is saying to Abacha in this story, "I'm not here as a senator. I'm just here to tell you that in the name of Jesus, we love you." But at the same time, Senator Inhofe is, in fact, a senator. And the contact that he's making there is a contact that he can also use as a senator. And if you do this in a country where, say, you're coming in the name of Jesus, but you're really a senator, and that country is looking for money, from grants from the United States, you could use your influence to get it. There's a lot of political favors that could be traded. And it's really a murky line there between what's church and what's state. In a visit like that, when a senator says that they're taking the name of Jesus to the kings.
I'm not surprised he would say something like that. That sort of is the message, that we're not there for politics, he said. And we're here to reach a different level of spiritual connection with you and ultimately with people in your parliament and elsewhere. And you usually start at the top to get clearance, particularly if there's some kind of ethnic trouble or religious trouble going on in the state that you're going to. Now, can you use those contacts wrong? Sure. I mean, there are definitely social climbers who come to the fellowship to try to meet important people. And there are people who might even try to make money. But the people I work with, they tend to fall away because that isn't the way it works.
But we're talking about Senator Inhofe here. We're talking about a very powerful senator who's going in the name of Jesus, but he's also a senator. And isn't that muddying the line between church and state?
I don't think so, because I think he's being clear there. He's saying that I'm not here on political state business.
But he's still a senator making an international trip, seeing a head of state.
You can't help who you are. I mean, can he have a friend?
But what got him in the door in the first place was being a senator. He says if you're a member of the U.S. Senate in Africa, they think you're important, so you always get in to see the king. So he's using his stature as a senator to see a head of state and then saying, I'm not here as a senator. I'm here representing Jesus.
Yeah. Well, as long as he—and I have no idea what he did in Nigeria, which is where Abacha was. As long as he keeps it clear and separate, I don't see it's a problem.
the way Jeff Charlotte portrays it, the fellowship is about trying to reach leaders, powerful people, and that there's one set of teachings for the powerful people and another set for people less powerful, but that the fellowship is really geared toward the powerful, whether it's members of Congress or heads of state in other countries.
Well, he calls it the elite. There is a ministry toward leaders in the fellowship. There are also ministries toward poor people in the fellowship. But, yeah, the fellowship does reach to leaders as part of the strategy to bring more unity into countries and into troubled situations.
Well, Bob Hunter, I appreciate your responding to us after our interview with Jeff Charlotte. I appreciate you coming on to talk about your response to it. Thank you very much. And I wish you a Merry Christmas and also a good and healthy New Year.
Well, thank you, Terry. Merry Christmas to you and to your listeners.
Bob Hunter is a longtime member of the secretive religious group, The Fellowship, also known as The Family. He's also director of insurance with the Consumer Federation of America. He was responding to an interview I did about the group, The Family, with Jeff Charlotte, the author of The Family. After that interview, Charlotte and Hunter met. Charlotte blogged about their meeting. You'll find a link on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross.